I just wanted to let it be known there's a correction to the notes. Yesterday, you may have noticed, if you were following along on the notes, that this equation, it also said it was equal to zero. But I was staying general for this proof in talking about out of equilibrium cases as well. So it's not true that this is equal to zero in general, only for equilibrium. The notes went through a couple of iterations, and at one point we were thinking about equilibrium. But so this is corrected now. But you know, if you like to download the notes and add to them, and you've already downloaded the notes, you can go ahead and just cross out the equals zero on that equation if you're the type that comments on notes and that sort of thing. So that's that. So we'll pick up where we left off. There are a couple of things I wanted to discuss a bit more about Liouville's theorem before moving on. And it also serves as a memory of what we were talking about yesterday. So let's go ahead and recall what we had. So from before, you know, we had this phase space called M, and then the points in the phase space, we used this Q and P notation for the position and momentum coordinates. And then we had Hamilton's equations that we said governed the trajectories of points through phase space. And we can write them in this way, using this anti-symmetric J matrix to connect the position and the momentum coordinates. And then from here, we got to the continuity equation, and that wasn't really a proof, but more of a justification, just talking about these points in general, that the continuity equation will hold for their trajectories. But then we used the fact that if we are looking at the trajectories, we have that if we take the divergence of rho times the velocity, according to these trajectories, where velocity really is our x dot, we actually simply get that this is going to be part of a total derivative of rho. And this would be a summation over A. And so we can actually say, well, for one thing, we get this statement yesterday that holds in general about our density matrix or our density function when we have Hamilton's equations. And this was Liouville's equation. But we can also take this fact according to when we go with the trajectories according to Hamilton's equation to say that this is actually equal to the total derivative if we are looking at points on these particular trajectories. And so we can say that total derivative along that trajectory for rho is equal to zero. So you can say rho is constant along trajectories in phase space. And then for equilibrium, we define equilibrium to be when there is no time dependence for rho in general. And so for an equilibrium, we can work with this relation. And this is what we will use to get various ensembles. But yeah, that was really the one last piece, that you can actually make this claim in general when you are following the trajectory of a point in throughout the phase space. And that really just comes from this relation that we proved using the Hamilton's equations. Any more questions on Liouville's theorem?
That statement always true?
Oh, sorry.
I mean, rho being like constant?
Along the trajectories in phase space, yes. That statement is always true outside of equilibrium. Rho can change in time when you take this these derivatives, but if you are taking derivatives along a trajectory, it stays constant. Okay, so we are going to talk about the ensembles soon, but first I wanted to discuss a concept called the Gibbs entropy, which is a way of defining the entropy from various distributions. So it will be useful to make contact with the various thermodynamic quantities. Yeah. So basically allows us to define the entropy S of a macrostate from the weights row of the microstates. So to do this, and as a review, let me just note that we know that if we take a state, and I'm really going to be thinking sort of in terms of the energies of the system. So I'm just going to use lambda, state lambda. Then we can define this this P lambda as the rho for lambda divided by the sum over all of these rows. So it's normalized. And so since it's normalized, this is going to be the probability of a state being in the state lambda. Okay. And so from that quantity, we can define the Gibbs entropy. As S equals minus K times the sum over lambda times the probability of being in state lambda times the natural log of the state being in lambda. Where this one, this K is going to be the Boltzmann constant. And as you know, the Boltzmann constant appears in the Boltzmann entropy definition that I'm sure you're familiar with. Okay, so I'm not really going to give a full proof of why, this is sort of a generalization of why it reduces, but I will give an example to motivate this Gibbs entropy. So we're going to start with some definition of rho lambda. And as we learned yesterday, rho commutes with the Hamiltonian. So one of the things that we could say that rho is, that's permissible, is we could just say rho is a constant, right? That's one of the things that rho could be that is legal according to this relationship we showed for equilibrium. And so suppose that we define this rho to be one for accessible configurations and zero otherwise. So I guess that's the only complication. Maybe in our configuration space, we are saying a certain subset of these configurations are accessible and some of them are not. So then what we would say is that S is equal to minus K times the sum over lambda . And then for each one of these lambda states, let's just say that there are W accessible configurations. So we'll give it the name W. This is really, and sometimes you see it called omega. You know, this is the quantity that tells you how large your phase space really is. In terms of. So then your entropy. What's the probability going to be, since it's equal, you know, equal rho for all these W configurations? So what is P lambda going to be in this case?
1 over omega.
Yeah, 1 over this W. And then the log, we have the P lambda again. So we have 1 over W. And then we have a sum over all the lambda states. So first of all, these are constants. One over W ln of 1 over W. And then we have a sum over K of 1. I'm sorry, sum over lambda of 1. So what is this sum going to be?
W.
Yeah, it's also W. So this is a really trivial example, but this is just to show that we'll end up with our Boltzmann entropy that we know. So this one is W. So we get minus K ln 1 over W, or just K log of W. And of course, this is a quantity that is indeed always greater than zero, greater than or equal to zero, and this is the Boltzmann entropy that we're familiar with. So you could see how from this sort of microcanonical ensemble sort of quantity you would get your entropy that you're familiar with. Okay. I will note, because you will use this some in your homework, or I think the tutorial tomorrow, there is also a continuous version, of course, and there's one complication involved. So you're going to have a probability of being in state. I'm just representing the microstate here as UP. And that is equal to rho of QP over our normalization. The entropy itself then is going to be defined as we've got an integral this time because it's continuous, and then we've got E of Q P here, but then we will also need to have this quantity W naught. Because the thing is, what we have here actually is not dimensionless. And so, because we have this rho, but then we have dq and dp, we've got this measure, which of course, in the discrete version, we did not have. And so, in order to take the logarithm of something dimensionless, we have to introduce this w naught, which is going to be, it's sort of a fundamental volume of phase space. And in practice, it's chosen in order to match experimental results. And tomorrow in your tutorial, you will actually have a problem where you can determine this fundamental volume. So that's something that you'll be doing there. Okay, but with that sort of formalism and definitions out of the way, we are ready to look at the more explicit forms of P, of rho, that is. So the first ensemble that you probably occurred in statistical physics is the microcanonical ensemble. And so, yeah, this one is the one that allows us to use the simple concept, the simple constant rho. And the thing for this one is that we assume that a system has a fixed energy and a fixed number of particles. So for continuous rho, we have rho is equal to 1 if the energy, so really if this HQP, this energy function, the Hamiltonian function of Q and P, is between the energy, one energy and one very small energy. So it's sort of an energy band definition. Uh, There's another way you can define it in your homework. There's another way that you can define this, and in your tutorial tomorrow, you'll actually use the second definition because it makes some of the calculations more straightforward. So you could also do rho is equal to a Dirac delta function of HQP over the energy of the system that you want minus one.
Is it right to say for continuous rho or for continuous energy?
For continuous energy and this rho is continuous too. It's not normalized, right?
But the way I see it is I have like some region of phase space where my rho is non-zero and then everywhere else is zero. I don't know what you mean by continuous.
Yeah, so if you think of rho corresponds to, you know, these Q's and these P's. And so this could be some continuous vector in phase space. It has a Hamiltonian energy that corresponds to every point in phase space. And so that energy, if it's in between these values, then it's equal to one for that rho. Otherwise, it's equal to zero. Now, it's not normalized. I agree with you there. In fact, yeah. Yeah, and maybe there's an issue with this that you would actually be equal to infinity or something like that if you summed up over it all. So this might be the better mathematical definition.
Continuous, you just mean continuous in the accessible configuration, not in the entire configuration.
So I'm not saying that this is a continuous function, right? If you're hopping between 0 and 1, that's definitely not the case. But could this take, you know, Rho's arguments are continuous, I guess. So maybe this is misleading, continuous rho for continuous QP. So then we have that W is equal to the integral over M dQn dNP. And so then the entropy, well, I'm not going to repeat it because it's really the same equation, the same progression of steps as before, just continuous instead of discrete, but you would then find that S is equal to K times the log of this W as defined in this way over W naught. And for the discrete system, we know that it's just K log W. So in practice, it's much more painful to use the microcanonical ensemble to calculate things than some of the other ensembles. So there is one problem that you'll look at for the ideal gas, and then you can compare among the different methods. But yeah, as analytic tools, there are some other ensembles that are more illuminating, you know, without having to do a bunch of calculation. So we're going to move on to those now. Okay, so let's move on to canonical ensemble. So for here, basically useful for systems at fixed temperature. And here we allow energy to fluctuate. And you can see how, from an experimental perspective, too, temperature is something that you have more control over than saying, I'm going to make the system to be at this energy, or something like that. So to do that, or to really sort of see where this one comes from, you can imagine a system, and let's just say its energy is ES, though we will allow this energy to fluctuate. And then we assume a much larger reservoir outside of it with an energy that I'll call ER for the reservoir. It's also called a heat bath. And the point is it sets and really fixes the temperature. Because we're assuming that it is going to be much bigger, as big as we like, to fix this temperature. And you can have exchange of energy between the two, but the temperature is going to be fixed. So the total energy then is just going to be, of course, E system plus the energy of the reservoir, which I'm going to call E naught or E total. And this is going to be constant. So we will sum them up, but the total energy for everything would remain constant. And the important thing is, like I said, we can make the reservoir as large as we want. We can make this E naught as huge as we like. And so really what we're going to be able to say is that the energy of the system is much less than the total energy. And so this can fluctuate, but it'll still be much smaller than the total energy. And what that really allows us to do is to say that the rho for the PQ of our system, which we know is related to the probability of being in this particular location of the phase space, is going to be proportional to the number of ways, the number of states available for the reservoir to be at its energy. Because it's really dominated by this energy of the reservoir. And so whatever the ways, which as we know is related to the entropy of this, this is really going to be proportional to the probability of this particular location, or this particular probability of being in this phase space for the system. So to be clear, this is for the system. This is not a rho q over all of phase space. You can add s's there, so that's clear. Okay, and so this is really the sort of hand-wavy part for the canonical ensemble, because, well, it's sort of assuming that we get the exponential form at the end, but I'll talk a little bit about that. Because what happens is this function itself, first of all, this W is huge, but more than that, it will fluctuate significantly. So it turns out that if you wanted to write some sort of Taylor expansion and figure out, write rho in terms of w here, you wouldn't be able to do it straightforwardly with the w function. You would, the series does not converge quickly. However, if you look at the logarithm of these very large numbers, then in many cases, and in the cases we'll see here, it works quite well. So you take the logarithm of both sides. Yeah, so we'll just start with that. And then we're going to expand using a Taylor expansion for the logarithms. And we're going to expand about E reservoir equal to E naught. Since we know that E reservoir is going to be most of the energy, then we can expand about this point. And when we do that, we get that the logarithm of rho q, oh, I put these in out of order. This should be PQ is proportional to the log at E naught, which is, of course, some constant, plus the derivative of the log of E with respect to E, but evaluated at E equal to E naught. Okay, and I'm going to end up rewriting this because it's we want to linger on this anyway for a bit. Okay, but you can at least see it better at this stage. Yeah, let me just rewrite it. Okay, and so then one of the points is this is a function, this w of e. So this is related to ds over de, the derivative of the entropy with respect to the energy. And from your thermodynamic quantities, you have that 1 over T is actually equal to partial S, partial E. And there should be, I think there's a K in there. Yeah, there should be the Boltzmann constant in there as well. And so what it really comes down to with these series is if we kept going, there would be higher order derivatives of the entropy with respect to the energy. So are those higher order derivatives small? And in terms of the physical systems that we'll be looking at, that is the case. That's something that you could actually look at when you look at the ideal gas, look at the derivative of entropy with respect to energy, because you will end up getting that expression. But there are cases such as in gravitational physics where it turns out that the canonical ensemble does not work to study them. So I could send you, maybe I'll put this in the resources if you're interested in learning about that. But in our cases, this canonical ensemble will work well. And so from here, we just get then that this part is some constant minus beta E system. Because remember, this is the energy of the reservoir minus E naught, and that's just going to be the minus energy of the system. And then this portion, we get the 1 over kT, which is our beta term. And so then we have that the density QP is proportional to the e to the minus beta HQP. And so indeed, you know, this is another thing that's consistent with what we have with rho and h. We have some function of h that we can use for rho. So then, if we're thinking about continuous systems, we can define a partition function where, you know, as you know, we're going to sum this over dnq dnp. And so we can also write then that our probability of being in this QP state is just equal to e to the minus beta HQP divided by the partition function Z. Okay, so then let's look at the Gibbs entropy for this one. And here we can use this continuous definition. So S is equal to minus K integral over M probability of QP log of probability QP W0 DNQ DNP. And then we can put in the values that we know. Okay, so from that probability, which we just defined up there, we're going to have a 1 over Z coming from this. And then we're going to have an e to the minus beta HQP. And then we're going to have the logarithm. And then we need to put this expression in here too.
Would you mind swapping the top and the middle?
Oh, yeah, that will make it a little bit more linear in terms of. Oh, is it hard to see some of the things up there, too?
Yeah, there's light, so it's.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so. Now we want to write more here. So notice with this log, there are a couple of pieces in the argument. There is a piece that's dependent on Q and P, so that will be important for our integral. But there's also a piece that's a constant. So I'm going to go ahead and break it up into two parts, and I'll look at the constant piece first. So I have minus K 1 over Z. So, you know, this is a product, so we can rewrite it as a sum. And I'm just going to write ln of W naught over Z on the outside. And then the second part. Now we just have the logarithm of this thing, but it's the logarithm of an exponential, so I'll bring it down. And I actually have minus minus, so I'm going to do a plus there. Then I have beta H 2P e to the minus beta H QP. Okay, so first of all, what is this piece right here? Am I missing something? Oh, yeah, I'm missing something important. So this part was still in both of the terms. So we should have so what is this integral right here? You look a board up and you'll see something.
Partition function.
Yeah. So this is just the partition function again. So so this is equal to Z. So we're going to get minus K log of W naught over Z. And then for this one, I'm going to write this as plus k beta. And then we have an h, and then times e to the minus beta h. And so remember what we talked about yesterday when we were computing ensemble averages. The point was, we have our row here. What we're doing is we're averaging an observable h. And what is h measuring for the system?
Energy.
Yeah, it's the energy. So we can just write this as K and beta, which I've pulled out. This is just the average energy. And it's normalized by the partition function. And so that goes into this average energy calculation. For this first one, I'm going to go ahead and flip the order so that it's Z over this fundamental volume. And so that's really the entropy that we have. And then for this one, to get to thermodynamics, we have that the free energy, which is equal to U minus U, which is the average energy again, or energy of the system, minus TS. We can say that this is then equal to minus KT log of Z over omega. So once you get the partition function for the canonical ensemble, if you can compute the partition function, then you can easily get to the free energy of the system. And then you can learn other things about the system from there. And I got this by just taking this expression for the entropy, putting it in here. You know, there's some k's that will be normalized out. And what you should get is this expression when you put this into that equation. Any questions here? Before moving on, I wanted to show you what's really more of a quick mnemonic, but it's a way of thinking about what the free energy is and a way of remembering what you're doing with it. So if we think about what is the free energy, well, we had the partition function, which we could think of as a sum over, you know, these rho q's of e to the minus beta times some h, sorry, with p q's. But you could also organize the sum in a different way. You could organize it according to the energies that you would get in your system, where you think about some omega energy, and this is the number of states with this particular energy. Times e to the minus beta times that energy. Because this is really just going to be the same sum, just reorganized in terms of the possible energies we have, and then the number of states that had those energies, because they will each come with the same term. And then you could rewrite this as a sum over the energies times e to the minus beta e plus the log of this omega for a particular energy. Which would be something like the entropy then for all the states with that energy. And then you could, and so then when you look at this, you really see there's sort of a fight. Because if you have a smaller energy, because it's e to the minus beta h, a smaller energy makes this exponential larger, right? Because you have e to the minus something small. On the other hand, for smaller energies, there are going to actually be fewer ways to get this omega. And so this thing you want to be larger, basically, of the two exponentials. So you can think of this as, you know, a long sum of all the possible things. And basically, the idea is that one term would dominate in it. And so then you could say this is proportional to e to the beta u minus t times the entropy of the system. And that's this part in the exponential is really the free energy. And like I said, this is not even, I think it goes beyond hand wavy, but I think it's useful to keep in mind, because this is something you'll see in research and minimization algorithms and whatnot. Basically, at equilibrium, when people are working on variational algorithms and whatnot, what you have is that at zero temperature, we minimize energy. To get to the equilibrium state. And then at finite temperature, we are minimizing free energy. And so this is really what people will do in various methods in order to find equilibrium states. So these functions, you know, this free energy function that we obtain is very useful. Okay, so the last ensemble I'll mention is the grand canonical ensemble, and it really follows a very similar progression to the canonical ensemble. So I will just sketch some of the relevant aspects. Okay, so for the canonical ensemble, we had temperature constant and we allowed energy to fluctuate, but we still kept the number of particles the same, just as in the microcanonical ensemble. In the grand canonical ensemble, we're going to allow both n, the number of particles, and the energy to fluctuate. So again, we've got some system, but now I'm going to associate it with a number of particles and an energy. And the reservoir with a number of particles and R and an energy R. And so, you know, similar to before, we have that ES plus ER is equal to the total energy that is going to be a constant. We also have that NS plus NR is equal to the total number of particles, which is also a constant. And then we'll do the same thing we had before, which is the probability of being in a particular state for the system is going to be proportional to this number of states available for the reservoir at a particular energy, ER, and a particular number of particles, NR, because the system itself is going to have ES and NS. And so as before, we write that the log of NPS, and then we are going to, just as we expanded the other one about E0, where ER is equal to E0, we're going to do ER equals E0 and NR equals N0. So proportional and sort of approximate. we get again some constant at the beginning. Plus the derivatives. So we have a derivative with respect to n. N system minus n total, which is going to give us the minus n, sorry, shouldn't be n system, should be n of the reservoir. Plus another derivative. And E equals E zero, as before, we get that we have the E reservoir minus E total. And so then the important thing is this tells us that the logarithm is going to be approximately some constant minus, we have our 1 over kt es piece, as before, that's this one. And then we also have a minus mu over kt ns. And again, the assumption here is going to be that all of these higher order derivatives are going to be diminished in this limit. Okay, and so we can actually write, so z is going to be the sum over we can actually simplify this as e to the beta mu n z n. Now, is there something off about my sign here? I think that this should be right. And then the probability of being in a particular state is e to the beta mu n minus beta e of some state with, you know, state lambda n. And then without showing the details, you can also get that this entropy is equal to minus k times the sum over n and lambda times the probability being an n lambda times the log p n lambda, which equals k log z minus mu times the average n over t plus the average energy over t. Just like we had that piece before, but now we've got an average particle number in here too. And so that tells us that if we have the grand partition function, we can make contact with the entropy. And then we also have that this is a potential that unfortunately doesn't really have a name in statistical physics, but this is the one sort of the analog of what we saw for the canonical ensemble. This, which is equal to PV and also equal to U minus TS minus mu N is equal to KT log of Z. And I know I have some funny signs in my notes, so in my board right now, or I had some. So check with your notes and your notes are going to be the correct signs. Okay, let's take a bit of a break until 1150. So as an example, let's just think about first a single two-state paramagnet. We just have basically a magnetic spin. There are two states for it. It can be spin up. Or spin down. Any other questions? Okay. And so then we're going to say the energy for spin up. Let's actually talk about the magnetic field. We're going to apply a magnetic field. That is going to be in the up direction. And so we're going to say that the strength of this magnetic field is just going to be B equals this little h.
Yeah,
and so, you know, if you have a magnetic field and it's in the up direction, then it's going to favor the paramagnet being up versus down. So we're just going to assign these energies, minus mu h if it's up, and then plus mu h if it's down, so that it's energetically disfavored for the spin to be misaligned from the magnetic field. It's just a two-state system, so. And so then the partition function, what would the partition function in this case be if we're thinking about the canonical ensemble?
Over kT plus e to the kT.
Yes, exactly. So we've got e to the beta e up, so beta mu h, and that was e up, so, oh, e to the minus beta, right? So e to the beta mu h plus e to the minus beta mu h. Okay, and so then that's just this hyperbolic Cauch expression. Okay, so then that's the probability of being spin up is just going to be this state, which you can see now e to the minus beta, e to the beta plus beta mu h is the probability of being up. That's going to be a larger value. Versus when it's down. And so, and then also you can see what is it in the case where there's no magnetic field, what are the how do the probabilities compare to each other if H is equal to zero? They would be equal in that case. So the expectation, if we're thinking physically, is that at high temperatures, there should be still plenty of thermal fluctuations in spin. But then at low temperature, you know, this is why I'm saying when we get to zero temperature, we minimize energy entirely. At low temperature, it should freeze and be aligned with the magnetic field. So we can compute the average magnetization, in this case, in a very simple way. You know, this energy corresponds to when it's up. This energy corresponds to when it's down. So the average magnetic moment is just going to be mu. That's mu up, so mu plus e to the beta mu h over the partition function. Minus, this is the down one, so this is the magnetization down. And that gives us mu times the hyperbolic tangent of beta mu h.
Yeah.
And so let's go ahead and plot this. Basically, we know that if we're going to plot the magnetization, and I'm going to plot it in terms of beta mu h. So when beta mu h is large, it's going to have a maximum at plus mu. When beta mu h goes to negative infinity, it's going to be at minus mu. And really the interesting part in here is around where beta mu h is approximately 1. And so as a note, this is a paramagnet. It reacts to the magnetic field. If there were no magnetic field, then there'd be no magnetization at all. This is the only place where we see no magnetization at all when beta mu h is equal to 0. So there's always some, but the interesting part is in here. Okay, so that's one paramagnet. So now we're going to move on to what if we had n of these paramagnets that aren't really interacting with each other. They aren't interacting with each other, just like a grid of paramagnets. So I'm going to put this in the middle. Okay. So what if we had n paramagnets? Well, in this case, it's actually pretty straightforward to get the full partition function and write it in terms of the original partition function. So if we have Z1 corresponding to one of these paramagnets, now we just want all the possible combinations of spin up and spin down. So we'll have all these binomials, right, these Z1s, and if we multiply all the binomials, we'll get all possible combinations of up and down for the paramagnets. So we can really just write the partition function for n of them as a Z1 to the power n. And so then we can use what I was talking about before over in the canonical ensemble. We can now use that expression for the free energy over on the far right by just taking minus kT times the log of Zn, or in other words, minus kT big N log of 2 cosh of beta mu h.
Emily, should there be 1 over n factorial?
Yeah, in this case, since I'm thinking about a grid, they actually have specific positions. But yes, that's a good point, especially when you're thinking about these gases and you have these indistinguishable particles.
Okay.
moving around, then you see those one over n.
Positions of the magnets are fixed.
Yeah, yeah. Because these are really just kind of like spins, living in a particular spot. Okay, so then we can get the magnetization. This is something that you'll be able to see in your list of identities by doing the derivative of the free energy with respect to H at a particular T. And that gives us N times mu tanh of beta mu H. But I could have, Right, I should be able to actually compute that. So we take the derivative of this with respect to H. Then we get these pieces out front, mu. We have beta is 1 over kt. That will cancel out the kt in the front when we take the derivative of the argument. So anyway, to go through the steps, we have the log of 2 cosh. Derivative of the log is 1 over 2 cosh, but then the derivative of the hyperbolic cosine is the sinh. So we have the hyperbolic sine over hyperbolic cosine, which gives us the hyperbolic tangent in the end. And then we multiply, of course, by the argument, do the chain rule, but it's a derivative with respect to h, so we don't get an h, we just get a beta mu in the front there. And then we can also get the entropy. And we should be able to get the entropy by our formula over there. So we can get, which is nk, but you can also get the entropy from the free energy here too, so. When you do that, you can plot the expression for the entropy with respect to beta mu h. And when you look at beta mu h equal to 0, this tanh is equal to 0, the cosh is equal to 1, so we have a maximum value of nk log 2 up here. And then what we'll find is that it decays. And again, large beta is going to correspond to very low temperature. So the point is, as we get to low temperature, we are going to have all of these spins, they are all going to align with the magnetic field. And so that is going to be the case with the lowest possible entropy. On the other hand, small beta, which is high temperature, what happens for high temperature? At high temperature, we're going to maximize the thermal fluctuations. So in this case, the high temperature, especially as we go to 0, we're basically making beta as large as we want, it dominates the magnetic field. And so at that point, all the spins, they can fluctuate however they like. And so that's really the case with maximum entropy. And then there's one more thing I wanted to talk about. It's the idea of what experimentalists study in this case. Really, what would they measure? because it's all well and good with this theory to say that the results that we see here are really consistent with what we would expect. To say that, okay, sure, at high temperature, we should have more entropy. Experimentalists aren't going to actually measure entropy. That's not a straightforward quantity to look at in the lab. So one of the things they would look at instead for this is this chi, which is isothermal susceptibility. And this is the derivative of the magnetization, which we can make up use of there, with respect to the magnetic field. Because you can measure the magnetization, you know the magnetic field that you applied. And so if you do that, if you take the derivative of this one with respect to H, you're going to get N mu squared beta hyperbolic secant squared beta mu H. And then if we think about how this one would plot, I had to think about a couple of things to really recall how a hyperbolic secant would look. So first of all, let's just remember what the hyperbolic cosh looks like. And then just like the secant is the inverse of the cosine, the hyperbolic secant is the inverse of the hyperbolic cosine. So if we are looking at the hyperbolic secant, it's going to look like this, where it has a maximum at 1, because you know that's where the cosh has its minimum. And so then if we are plotting, we can plot this chi as a function of t, because what we're doing is we're seeing, you know, what is this susceptibility at each one of these temperatures. And we'll get two different plots depending on whether H is zero or non-zero. They're actually two fairly different plots. So for H equal to zero, we'll get something like this. Because at H equals zero, yeah, basically we just are plotting 1 over KT. And so, you know, it's going to blow up here when we have 1 over T equals 0. And so, again, this is a susceptibility. The idea physically as a susceptibility is really it's taking this magnetic field you're applying and saying how susceptible is the system to it? How much is the system going to change or fluctuate with the addition of that magnetic field? Because you really have the derivative, how is the magnetization change when we add the magnetic field? And in some cases, the magnetization will respond quite a bit to it. Some cases, it won't respond very much at all. So if we think about this sort of extreme case where H is equal to zero, and then we take T equal to zero, so that's a zero temperature system, but there's no magnetic field to it. So right now, the spins still have no energetically favored state there, and they would just fluctuate however. But if you added even the tiniest bit of magnetic field, immediately they would just align like that, because you're at zero temperature, so they're just going to immediately go there. So that's why you really have this explosion of susceptibility at zero temperature. On the other hand, if you plot something like the case where H is not equal to zero, so that's this one, you're going to get something a little bit more complicated. You're going to have a peak, and it's somewhere around that beta mu H goes to 1. And that is because we now have this secant that we're multiplying by, and when as t goes to zero, that's the same as beta goes to infinity. So this hyperbolic secant is going to go to zero as we get here. So it fixes sort of that huge blow up you would see. And physically, again, you can think about that because now at zero temperature, we already have a magnetic field here. So if you add a little bit more, the spins are already fully aligned. So that's why they're not susceptible anymore if you already have a magnetic field. And I think that's probably a good place to end. If we think about the high temperature limit, on the other hand, it makes sense that neither of these are going to be very susceptible in the high temperature limit. Things can fluctuate freely. You add a magnetic field, the temperature is high, things are still going to fluctuate.
Confused of H is the strength of the magnetic field applied.
Yes.
Does susceptibility mean if you already have a magnetic field applied and then applying another field to it?
Yeah, if you increase it a bit, because that's the derivative, right? What if H changes? How does M change? So you know, with a little bit of change in H, how does the magnetization of the system change?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and as I said, I'm going to have to leave rather quickly today. I could stay around for another 5 minutes, though, so if you do have some questions.